Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 1st, 2025, we are delighted to host this litigation update entitled Attorneys' Fees as Deterrence in Civil Rights Cases. My name is Matthew Sautel, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Aaron Murphy as our speaker and Jeremy Dice as our moderator. Jeremy is Senior Counsel for First Liberty Institute. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom so that we'll have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Jeremy, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Matthew, and I'm pleased to have my friend and oftentimes co-counsel Aaron Murphy to join us. We've done a number of cases together, including one we're going to talk about later on today. And as we get into the topic of civil rights, and especially the attorney's fees that are included at the end of many of these civil rights cases, I want to get us a kind of a running start. So to do that, we're going to jump back all the way to 1871 with the Civil Rights Act of 1871, which was passed, of course, during the Reconstruction era as a means really of enforcing the Civil War Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. That later becomes, or is becoming at that point, what we now know as 42 USC 1983, or just 1983 in short for civil rights practitioners. That then goes on for some years and gets us to 1964, where we have the Civil Rights Act of 1964, aptly named, that's at 2000D of the 42 Code. But that expands civil rights protections, and mainly on the basis of race, color, and national origin. There's a significant difference between the two, and it's relevant for our purposes here today and the discussion we're going to get into. In 1871, in that Civil Rights Act version, Congress did not include any provision for the award of attorney's fees for a prevailing party. But in 1964, Congress explicitly provided for the recovery of fees for prevailing parties that bring suit under 1983. So you might be able to say that the 1871 Civil Rights Act provided enforcement by the U.S. Attorney General, but the Civil Rights Act of 64 provides a means of private enforcement of the nation's civil rights laws, deputizing, in effect, a bunch of public interest lawyers to become deputized as private attorneys general. Well, that's all working fine until we get to a pretty significant case in 1975 named Lieska Pipeline Service Company versus the Wilderness Society. And just a little background on that case, it goes to the Supreme Court. The Wilderness Society brings a lawsuit pursuant to the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. The litigation leads Congress eventually to pass new legislation that effectively achieved the goals that the Wilderness Society had as a part of its litigation. And so the Wilderness Society turns around and submits a fee bill for the litigation that now more or less was resolved due to Congress's actions. They claimed in their fee bill that the action that they had taken had acted upon, quote, the important statutory rights of all citizens, and therefore ensured the governmental system functioned properly, according to their pleadings. And therefore, because of their good acts on behalf of the rest of the country and really acting on behalf of Congress in some respects, they were entitled to fees. Well, the Court of Appeals agreed to that point. But the Supreme Court of the United States reversed that decision of the appellate court. The justices concluded that absent some authorization by statute, even in civil rights cases, fees are supposed to be retained by the parties bringing the suits. You cannot recover fees, even if you're the prevailing party at that time, unless there is some sort of statutory mechanism to do so. So they're hewing back to what is now known as, or has been known as, the American rule. Everybody pays their own way when they go through the legal system, even in civil rights cases, unless there's an act of Congress to explicitly say you are entitled as a prevailing party to fees. Well, that then leads to the Civil Rights Attorneys' Fees Awards Act of 1976. Following Alaska, the Congress entertains the idea of adding these attorney's fees to prevailing parties in civil rights disputes. And this is due in part to the rise, as I mentioned before, of the public interest lawyer. Justice Thurgood Marshall speaking actually in Montreal in 1975. So following the, following the Alaska decision, he goes on to laud the work of public interest lawyers, but notes that, quote, public interest law has always had one major problem. And any of us who've worked in this space know exactly what that problem might be. He says, funding. Public interest law has always had one major problem, funding, according to Justice Marshall. He says, realistically, busy lawyers with paying clients are not genuinely inclined to give scarce hours to a demanding public interest practice. And while he said that court-awarded fees are not an elixir for the funding problem, he nonetheless believes that it is the responsibility of Congress to provide for the award of attorney's fees if it wishes to make it possible for private parties to enforce certain federal laws. Well, this is a speech that is sort of resounding, and it echoes all the way into the halls of Congress, where Congressman Robert Kastenmeier heeds that call, and he begins to lead the efforts with a number of other congressmen and senators to amend the law accordingly. Responding directly to the court's holding in Alyeska, Congressman Kastenmeier, in a hearing before the committees in the Congress, says, the future effectiveness of many statutes will depend on whether successful plaintiffs can recover attorney's fees under them, and if the cost of private enforcement actions becomes too great, there will be no private enforcement whatsoever. So if we're going to have the private enforcement of our nation's civil rights laws, he says, basically, you're going to need to find a way to pay for the attorneys who prevail. So Congress adopts Section 1988 in the federal code, and they allow prevailing parties to recover fees in civil rights cases filed under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as well as it would become amended several times to include these various ones, Sections 1981, 1982, 1985, Title IX, Title 34, and then, of course, much more recently, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and its land use corollary, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. So all of those now are entitled to attorney's fees in civil rights litigation pursuant to Section 1988, thanks to the laws passed in 1976. So that is sort of the preliminary background that gets us the running start into this conversation about fees as a deterrence in civil rights litigation. So Aaron, let me turn to you here before we get into the case update section of this actual teleforum. This, I think, appears to be the import of Congress's slow moving decision making and regarding attorney's fees. It seems to, what do you make of Congress allowing for fees for prevailing parties?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's a recognition of what Justice Marshall said back in the day, which is it is a reality that you have to have some incentives that make this workable. Now, it's an interesting dynamic because I think the world has changed in some significant respects since when Congress put fees into place. You have a lot more entities that are willing to do this kind of work. You have a lot more public interest entities. You have a lot more law school clinics and centers and all of these different types of organizations. And you also have, you know, law firms that are willing to put their resources toward at least some types of matters. We can talk a bit about, you know, whether they are doing that quite as fairly across the board at some of the bigger firms. But at the end of the day, what kind of animated this back then remains true, which is no matter how you're doing it, you still need some funding. You need some source of that. And fees are a really important component of that, especially for folks who are really trying to do this, not do public interest work as like, oh, we're at a giant firm that has lots and lots of resources and can spare some to do this kind of work. But as you know, we are really going to be an organization, a smaller firm, a public interest group, whatever it is that's dedicated to this. Like, it may not be that everything's going to come from there, but it's a significant component of it. And the other piece too is it's not kind of just even about the lawyers. I mean, we've certainly had cases where it's about ensuring that perhaps our client is a public interest group that itself needs the funding to be able to kind of be serving its members and their ability, maybe their hiring counsel, and that's that's going to enable them, put them in a little bit different position, but they want to be in a spot where they can actually get back the money that they've put into litigation. So I think in some respects, you know, that you've also had a rise, you know, not just of the groups who are willing to be the lawyers, but also of kind of public interest groups that are willing to be the clients, you know, makes it even more important to have this as one of the paths toward ensuring that you have a financial incentive for people to do this work. Because it's all well and good to hope everybody would just do it out of the goodness of their hearts. But, you know, like, lawyers do have to make a living.
Yeah, I think that gets right at Justice Marshall's recognition of busy lawyers with paying clients are generally not inclined to give scarce hours to a demanding public interest practice, which is why there's got to be some level of motivation to get us to that point. Let me turn to the case that has brought us sort of to the point of having this conversation, which is His Tabernacle versus James. This is a case that First Liberty Institute and Clement and Murphy worked on together, especially Aaron, you were deeply involved in this with us. To set it up, this is right after another one of the cases you worked on with Paul, Bruin, the New York Gun and Rifle, which I always forget the first part of that. We'll just call it the Bruin decision. Mere days after the Bruin case comes down, the New York legislature changes their law, and they change it in a way that allows private businesses to allow people to lawfully to determine whether they're going to allow people to carry guns lawfully on their place of business. But it explicitly excludes churches from being able to do so, and other houses of worship for that matter as well. First Liberty, Clement and Murphy, we file a lawsuit on behalf of His Tabernacle Church in Elmira, New York. We allege both the Second Amendment, which seems obvious and logical, but we also make claims under both religion clauses of the First Amendment as the defenses of saying that we think the state has overstepped here where they should not have stepped. We point out that the history and tradition test applies whether if you're going under the First Amendment or the Second Amendment. It's the same test. And that this has been a consistent and common practice in the country to allow weapons to be permitted on America's church campuses and for the purposes of their security. In fact, one of my favorite parts of what we did in that case is we put pictures in the complaint, including that very famous painting of the pilgrims marching to worship services. You know, the parson sort of in the middle, and their pilgrims are on both sides wearing their buckled shoes and their pilgrims hats, carrying blunderbusses, which I don't know if that's, if we've used blunderbusses in litigation pleadings before, but it's pretty cool that we did in that case. It's at least one of my favorite parts. Anyhow, we succeed with the district court. The court preliminary enjoins the law, and New York appeals, along with many other cases in the state of New York, to the Second Circuit. And most of the other cases, I think, failed, having alleged only Second Amendment grounds. We were able to survive, I think, mainly on our First Amendment arguments in that case. So that's a great win. But then we spend the next roughly 2 years trying to get the state of New York to pay their fair share of having challenged this law. Now, it wasn't the first time that their gun laws have been challenged either, so they should have perhaps known better. But still, they determine after a while and in their papers to the court that you and I, Clement Murphy and First Liberty Institute, were entitled to just 16% of the fees that we had submitted within our fee application. So this is where I want to get to your question. Your team, especially Aaron, did a really great job, a magnificent job of briefing this issue. We were able to pitch in a bit, but your team did such a fine job with that. Let me ask you to sort of overview the arguments we made in our fee application, especially with an eye towards explaining both how history that we've been through already on civil rights cases and attorneys' fees, as well as the topic of our teleforum today on the issue of deterrence. Just kind of overview how we made the arguments and framed them to the court in our application.
Sure. So we really had kind of a two-prong approach to this. You know, one was to just draw on the general principle of, you know, you should get compensated fairly for the work that you do in this area. And that's what the civil rights, that's what providing fees in these civil rights cases is all about. You know, if you provide some measure of fees and it's really working out as a loss all the time, you're not really accomplishing that much by saying, well, at least we won't make you do your work completely for free, but we won't pay you anything near kind of the actual value of it. You know, that's a problem. So a big part of our fee application, as with any, was demonstrating this is in fact the work we did. This is what, you know, we are fortunate. In some respects, I think this makes it a little bit easier and was why it's helpful for us to kind of lead on all of this, that, you know, we're not a public interest group. We're a law firm that does a whole bunch of different work. And so it's not some hypothetical that these are fees that people would actually pay us to spend our time doing other work if we were not willing to do this. you know, that's a fact. They are fees that we charge all the time and get paid by clients for all types of work. Many of, you know, some of it is civil rights work, but a lot of it is not. And so, you know, we were able to make a very strong case for this is what it costs for us to actually do this. And then what we paired that with was to really make a pretty candid argument about why it's not fair or consistent with the objectives of fee shifting to keep giving states a huge discount all the time. And part of, you know, what we were particularly helped by the fact, as Jeremy alluded to, that we happened to be litigating against a state that had like a recent really bad track record on both the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. I mean, New York is the defendant in Bruin. New York was actually involved in a case, a Second Amendment case, just a couple of years earlier that ended up going away because they essentially, you know, got the city to moot it. And then New York had, during COVID, been at the forefront of some summary reversals in pretty strong terms on religious liberty grounds, of having really been pretty just kind of openly discriminatory in the way that the state set up the exemptions it would and would not allow to extremely strict COVID restrictions. And so we had this very powerful case to make that, you know, this, here we are with a state that is like, in fact, a serial infringer upon these rights in high profile ways in recent years. Yet the state had really not had to face much beyond losing. And Bruin was, you know, kind of, I mean, we talked about on it, I think on like the first page of our brief in our introduction, the fact that after we won the Bruin case, which, you know, changed, I mean, got rid of a New York law that had been in the books for 100 years, the NRA filed a fee application and ended up getting about 35 cents on the dollar for what it had actually cost them to pay for the work it took to get that case turned around. And we said, you know, like it, part of the fees is that you have to ensure that the state actors who are engaging in constitutional violations get the message that it's not just that they can defend themselves and hope for the best, and if they lose, oh well, you know, there should be some consequence beyond that. And so we really kind of leaned into the fact that it is relatively, you know, it's pretty common. It's very common for when fee applications come up. If you look back at the opinion in the Bruin fee application, I mean, they decided that like the rate for Paul Clement should be like $550 or something. I mean, that's not what people pay for either of us. And, you know, they reduced everybody's rate. They were at least fair enough to our firm about the hours we put in, but reduced a lot of hours. And just, you've got a court looking and saying, you didn't really need all of this and that. And, you know, I mean, you just end up in a situation where what is actually being paid in attorney's fees doesn't reflect anywhere near what it actually costs to litigate the case. And that one was a particularly powerful illustration because, as NRA explained in its fee application, like they paid for lawyers. You know, it wasn't an after the fact, this is what it would have cost. It was, here's what we paid. Here are our invoices of what we paid that we're trying to recover. And so, you know, it just, I think that message, that kind of 1-2 punch, ended up being something that resonated with our judge in terms of thinking about it through the lens of, look, like sometimes cases take particular types of counsel and I should look at what they really cost, what it really costs for people to do this kind of work. And you shouldn't discount that just because the party on the other side is a government actor, because it's not like there's something baked into the fee shifting provision that says, well, you should shift fees, but man, don't shift like what they really are, because that would cost the state a lot of money. I mean, fee shifting should be about fee shifting, and you kind of shouldn't bake into it the idea that, of course, you'd never get what you're actually worth. And so we really tried to just like take as a given, that's where the approach often is, and say, here's why you shouldn't take that approach in this case.
Yeah, and it strikes me that an element of deterrence is actually the level of competency of counsel. I mean, the Attorney General of the United States has a level of institutional competence and quality that is somehow supposed different. But, you know, when you add into the equation groups that are sort of specialized in an area, whether that's the NRA or First Liberty Institute or firms like yours that are just filled with top-notch attorneys, including you and Paul, that are amongst the best in the nation on, especially on the appellate practice, that level of competency has its own level of deterrence, at least it should. Like if you're going to go up against if the state of New York is going to face an opposition based upon Dewey, Suum, and Howe versus Clement and Murphy, it's a sort of a different calculus when it comes to making those cases. And I think that's what the court in its opinion, Judge Sinatra, he awarded 100% of our fees just to get to chase to the end of the story. And he explained that, quote, this is the type of rare and important case with broader implications in terms of the state of the law that justify the most highly specialized and highly qualified counsel, irrespective of geography, which, you know, being referred to as highly specialized and highly qualified, I think makes you and I feel quite good. But it is nonetheless true that that is what this client was able to obtain to vindicate his rights. And it also, I think, echoes what Judge Sinatra says, echoes the language of Congressman Kastenmeyer back in 1976 when he says, if the cost of private enforcement actions becomes too great, there will be no private enforcement. So the high quality caliber of attorneys in the public interest field, at least, is going to go down significantly, and that level of deterrence is going to go away. So the open-ended question that I have for you at the end of that is, what do you make of the significance of what Judge Sinatra is saying here, contrasted against what Congress intended in 1976?
I mean, I think it's nice to see a judge saying what strikes me as what I think Congress did intend, which is, you know, we don't just want to give you like some small little, you know, kind of reward as a thanks for doing this. We want to ensure you're paid for your work. And it seems to me pretty at odds with what Congress was trying to accomplish to see courts routinely say, you know, as you were alluding to with the sort of localized dynamic, like, well, yeah, they may have actually done all this work and this may be what your lawyers actually cost, but I think you could have accomplished the same thing with some cheaper lawyers. I mean, you know, why? Why do you think that? What is your basis for thinking that? You really don't have one. I appreciate wanting to, you know, say great things about local bars, and there's many, many wonderful attorneys in them, but there are cases that, you know, just are going to require a different kind of specialty. And frankly, you know, that's evident from the fact of the choice that firms make to bring them on. I mean, just as, you know, I'm sure you guys deal with the same dynamic in First Liberty. We don't take every case that somebody asks us to do pro bono. We make choices about which cases are there. I mean, we don't take any case at all, even not in the pro bono realm, but, you know, we make choices about what is actually the best use of us, the kind of resources we have, where our skill set is. You know, this was like a dream case for pair up on, you know, given the First Amendment and Second Amendment dynamics of it. But it should matter that cases attract those kind of lawyers, because we're not, you know, we are fortunate enough that we're not doing these cases so we can make attorney's fees on them. You know, we are making choices about where we think our resources can be very valuable to clients. But that said, you know, when we make those choices and have to make them assuming that we're not going to be able to be fully compensated, you know, that makes it harder and limits the capacity we have. If we had more courts that approached this like Judge Sinatra, we would be able to take on an even bigger docket of these kinds of cases. And so I think it's a great thing to see. I mean, the other thing that, as you mentioned before, was, you know, just to me goes to show why this idea that it doesn't, you know, well, there's good lawyers everywhere, so we'll just pay you what other ones cost, doesn't make sense. I mean, you know, we together with you guys, and this is one of the great things about, you know, appearing with you guys on this case, like the more natural instinct most people had was to challenge this on Second Amendment grounds. I do a lot of Second Amendment work and I completely get that. But the whole reason we brought another lawsuit, even though some had already been brought, was because we thought there was also a very strong First Amendment argument here. And what ended up happening is that when the state, as often happens when you actually have really strong constitutional arguments against provisions of law, they changed the law, and they changed the law in a way that essentially mooted out the Second Amendment claims. But by virtue of us having brought broader claims, our case was not moot. And that's why we were able to get relief and get relief on the First Amendment before a court that was not, it was in the context of a big omnibus case that involved a lot of Second Amendment issues, and the panel was not friendly at all on any of the Second Amendment issues in the case. I think we might be like the only issue that anybody prevailed on, and it was on First Amendment grounds. And I'm not here to tell you there's no other lawyers out there that would have made that choice, but you know, you had this like great illustration of a choice that counsel made actually being the reason we were there to get fees. Yet at the same time, the state in its opposition brief said we should get no more fees than what they'd agreed to pay in a settlement to a different set of plaintiffs who didn't win because they only brought Second Amendment claims and their challenge was moot. It was like, how can that be what Congress intended? That the actual prevailing party, you know, should be measured by what we were willing to pay a party that didn't, and we should ignore in the process the fact that, you know, strategic decisions were made that enabled the client to get relief. So I appreciate, you know, where courts are sometimes coming from in thinking about it as, look, we don't want this to be, you know, just like a boon that you go get the lawyers that will cost the most. But I don't think that's a real concern, because the types of lawyers that can demand very high fees, you know, are not going around taking cases just to like gin up a bunch of attorney's fees out of these types of cases. They're being very, you know, putting a lot of thought into which cases to take, where they think they can actually do something valuable, where you appreciate that it's going to take real litigation. Because if it's some easy case, you're not going to get any real fees out of it anyway. It's, you know, if there's not actual litigation. The one other thing that I would note that was a dynamic we faced here that is I wish more courts would focus on was, it's particularly frustrating when you see the haircuts happen in cases where part of the reason the fees are as high as they are is because of litigation choices that were made by the defendants. And this was a classic illustration of that, where we had a client that really there was no need for the state to get into any, you could have just taken everything he said at face value in his declarations at face value, but they insisted on cross-examining him at a hearing and, you know, having us bring him up there. And that, as an appellate litigator, I can tell you, you know, like that process of having to prepare a witness and present a witness, it adds a huge cost as compared to just doing briefs. And so it's particularly, you know, I think some courts have the instinct, they look at like the absolute dollar amount and don't pay a lot of attention to, well, wait a second, did, you know, there's obviously cases that go through much more of this than we did, but is some of this because, you know, the state chose to force a case through onerous discovery for a very long time that maybe wasn't super necessary, or, you know, made litigation choices that left the civil rights plaintiff with no choice but to put a lot more resources than you would have needed to if everyone was willing to agree, look, this is kind of just a legal dispute. And so I think sometimes that gets a little bit lost in the analysis too.
Yeah, and the level of preparation is enormous, and the types of individuals needed for that preparation become just as vital as well. And again, the questions that the state asked on that of our client were in the nature of sincerity of belief, which is almost shocking to ask a pastor whether or not he's got a sincere belief in the protection of his flock as a shepherd of a flock. It was rather shocking to go through all that. But, you know, it was not just, you know, Aaron Murphy and Jeremy Dice making the preparation. There were associates that were heavily involved. My former colleague, now Judge Jordan Pratt, was deeply involved, not only in the briefing of this case, but also in the preparation of the client at the time, as were many others. So that's significant. And you brought up the issue of haircuts, which is sometimes a sensitive issue for guys like me. But nonetheless, I want to read the conclusion of Judge Sinatra's opinion. And he makes this that same allusion. And I want to put that in some context, too. He says this: this was a rare and exceptional case demanding experienced counsel at the top of the practice from wherever they can be located. A reasonable client would pay for this very result. It bears noting, too, that the judicial system encourages lawyers to take meritorious cases like this one to ensure that proper incentives exist to achieve that appropriate compensation is required. So here again, we're echoing everything we've already talked about, plus what has been said in Congress and Justice Marshall. He ends with this. He says, perennial haircuts will discourage well-qualified counsel. That's the point I want to jump off from there. He alludes to these perennial haircuts, which I think gets us to the central issue beyond just the issue of competent counsel, is the other element of expense. And in some respects, the expense that comes out of this case is hardly a rounding error in the budget of the state of New York. Nonetheless, it is significant. There are two cases that I want to serve as examples to get at the point of perennial haircuts. The first one is another case that was one you worked on, Aaron, Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. That's a case we litigated together, and it took us about 7.5 years to get all the way through that case. I had to go up to the Ninth Circuit, to the Supreme Court, back down to both, and then up again to the Supreme Court. The parties agreed. And I should also mention that shift, that end of the Lemon Test, that shifted the law for 50 years in this country. It was a game changer of a case. But the parties at the end of it, after making that massive change in the law, agreed to an attorney fee award of just $1.875 million in attorney's fees. That's for all the attorneys, and there's about 60 of them that hit on that case in the course of its lifetime, including you and me. But to contrast that, let's look at the year 2005 in the case of Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District, which is a case that the Americans United for Separation of Church and State brought. They took it only to the stage of summary judgment in the district court, didn't go beyond that, and they obtain a fee award from the court of $2 million. So you have about an 18-month piece of litigation, not even quite that long, actually, versus 7.5 years, and roughly they're separated by $225,000 or so, or $125,000 from the attorney's fees. And I'm having a difficult time making sense of that, where you have short-lived litigation from sort of a left-leaning a public interest firm versus a 7.5 years worth of litigation by a much more right-leaning firm. I don't quite understand how that disparity exists, but maybe you can make some sense of it for us.
Look, I'll say a couple of things. First, I think Kennedy, that's such a classic example of, litigation choices like driving up the costs and then not getting compensated for it because, the level of record development and everything that had to happen in that case that really didn't need to happen in that case when all was said and done. And the state could have taken a really, really different approach to that litigation. And instead you have them basically drive up, all of these district court costs and the need for multiple rounds of appeals. And then effectively, we got compensated for winning at the Supreme Court and most of the rest of it went by the wayside. And that shouldn't be happening no matter what, but it certainly shouldn't be happening when part of the reason litigation drags on the way it does is because of decisions that are made about we want to drag this on and we're okay with that. And we're going to do a lot of invasive discovery and a lot of rounds of this, that, and the other. So it's particularly frustrating, I think, that sometimes you see this approach that seems to be like, well, we should kind of really only have to pay you for that part you won. But that gets to the other part of the dynamic. The best thing I can, there is certainly one way to look at that, which is to say that, you've got courts that have different views about how valuable they think different types of civil rights claims are. And that is an issue. And it's particularly also to the extent that is a mentality on the courts at this point, it's a particularly frustrating one because the unfortunate reality is it's easier, I think, for certain types of cases to find very big law firms that are pretty resource insensitive and don't even often care about getting their fees if they were to litigate the cases, that are happy to provide the pro bono assistance. And then you have different types of cases, Second Amendment type cases, for some types of First Amendment cases, more in the religious liberty sphere, where it's a lot harder to find, though, you know, firms that are able to do that kind of representation and willing to do that kind of representation, you know, that don't really care about getting the fees back, you know. So it's to the extent that's the explanation, it's really a tough one, because it just kind of makes a difficult dynamic even worse. I will say, though, one of the other difficulties with fee awards, with seeking them and with exercising your judgment about when it's worth seeking them versus trying to settle, is, you know, it's quite a different experience to go before a district court who thought you were wrong, versus a district court who all along thought you were right, and feels vindicated in your victory. And, you know, I don't think, like, if I compare, you know, the Bruin case actually came out of the same district, but a different judge in New York. But, you know, if I don't think, like, it's an accident that we got a great fee award out of a judge who thought we were right, and saw us prevail on appeal. I think sometimes the hardest dynamics you face are when you have a district court judge who absolutely thought you were wrong and was appealed and vindicated on appeal, you know, you lost on appeal, and then they get reversed by the Supreme Court. You know, not every district court judge responds to that by thinking, oh, I'm really kind of, like, chagrined that I got it wrong. Some of them are still quite convinced they got it right, and they're not going to be the absolute most favorable forum for the argument of, you know, hey, we had to work really hard to accomplish this great victory and vindicate civil rights, and the other side is a pretty bad actor who really needs to be deterred.
Yeah. Matthew's going to come back in a minute, not right now, but he's going to come back with some questions for us. So if you got any more questions that are listening, feel free to put those in the Q&A chat there, and Matthew will address those in a moment. But I want to get to one final question with you, Aaron, before we get to the questions from the audience. And I want to put it pointedly, because, again, we style this as civil rights fees as deterrence, right? And so I think we've covered the ground on it all. And I want to just sort of put the binary choice to you and answer the question of, what is the deterrence effect contemplated by Congress in the award of attorney's fees for prevailing parties in civil rights litigation? I'll give you the choice of the two binaries here. One is it meant to encourage the private enforcement of our nation's civil rights laws by competent counsel, or is it meant to penalize and therefore prevent the recurrence of government entities depriving the civil rights of its citizens? Which one would you come down in that camp, or are you unwilling to land on either one?
I mean, I really think it's both. You know, I think, like, you can certainly find, if you're going to look at, you know, legislative history and how everything came about, plenty of support for the idea of, like, the goal is we have to compensate. But, you know, it sure also seems like part of the point is to say, you know, in normal contexts, we don't have fee shifting. And I think in most of the contexts when Congress does authorize fee shifting, it's not simply about we want to ensure that there is, you know, compensation for those who take on these cases. It tends to be we want to ensure that these laws get enforced, and we want to ensure that, you know, the violations of them stop. I mean, if you really are concerned, as Congress was, about wanting to create an incentive structure that ensures that you will maximize enforcement by both private parties and government actors, then inherently part of that is that your goal is you want maximum enforcement. And so that all just, to me, ties back to, like, of course, deterrence is an incredibly important part of it, because what you're trying to do is tell, you know, potential bad actors, hey, it's going to be a lot harder for you to get away with this because we've ensured that there's an army of people ready to come after you if you do. And by the way, you know, we're going to make you compensate them for all of that. I mean, that of course should be a deterrent, and I think it's intended to be. But I think whichever way you think about it, like, it doesn't, you know, either way, you're not accomplishing what Congress set out to accomplish if you're not actually ensuring that people are fairly compensated for the work that they're doing in civil rights cases. Because if the compensation isn't sufficient, it's, you know, it's an insufficient deterrent and it's an insufficient incentive if people are really only going to get, you know, 35 cents on the dollar anytime they do a civil rights case. Like, realistically, yes, there are plenty of great attorneys out there who will say that's fine. Okay. Frankly, that's partly because they are working really hard to find other funding sources, not just because they're willing to work for 35 cents on the dollar. But there are good lawyers who are have to make a financial judgment. And I can tell you, as you know, a founding partner of a small firm, like, we do owe it to the people who work for us to make decisions about how to ensure, you know, to make decisions that are financially sensible for the firm. And that sometimes, absolutely, it makes sense to be doing stuff pro bono. There's wonderful things about that. And it's wonderful opportunities for people. And, you know, there's many, many benefits to it. But sort of the smaller you are, like, the more you have to be really thoughtful about all of that. And it sure helps if you have the opportunity to actually be compensated at a reasonable measure for the work that people put in.
Well, I'm satisfied with that answer, because I actually started this project with the notion that it would be that the fees are actually a deterrent effect. And I think that is the case the further down the governmental stream you go. In other words, in Jasper, Georgia, it's going to be a lot more expensive for a civil rights violation. If, you know, it's going to feel more for the city council there than it is for the state of New York. Right. I mean, again, our fee shifting was barely a rounding error for their budget, I'm sure. But it's significant nonetheless if you take that to the backwoods of Northwest Georgia. But at the same time, the state of New York needs to have that highly competent counsel motivated to take their civil rights litigation seriously to enforce these laws. And so Congress, I think, is happily satisfied either way. Either you're reminding city and county governments that this is going to negatively affect your small budget, or you're reminding behemoth state governments that your trillion-dollar budgets are going to be affected by, you know, wizened counsel that are going to make their correct arguments. So I think you make the case correctly. And we're going to turn to Q&A, but let me first just thank you again, Aaron, for taking the time to set this all up, to spend the time of your day. I can't compensate you for the hour that you've now spent with us here, but perhaps we'll be able to shift that fee to FedSoc or somebody else later on. But Matthew, what kind of questions does the audience have? Has anybody been outraged that we have actually quoted positively Justice Marshall in a FedSoc forum?
No outrage, but there was actually a request to know where that quote was from. So,
yeah, that quote came from a speech he gave in 1975 in Montreal. And if you look up the congressional hearing on the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Award Act of 1976, you too can read the speech in full. It was added to the record there. That's where I found it. So I couldn't quite tell who he was speaking to, but you know, it was somewhere north of the border. So I kind of gave up caring after I saw Montreal.
Great. There were a couple questions that were easy to handle. They were just asking whether the fee petition and briefing are publicly accessible, whether they could read those.
Yeah, they're certainly on PACER. And I think we actually have a couple. We certainly have the opinion on firstliberty.org from Judge Sinatra. I don't recall if we have all the other briefing, but we'd be happy to provide it if you can't find it on PACER. I don't know, maybe Aaron, you know of a better place to find them.
Yeah, I have them, but I'm not aware of anywhere we've publicly posted them, but they're certainly publicly available. So we can follow up and
share. And I would really encourage folks to read. We played a part in that at First Liberty. I don't want to distance myself too far from it, but Aaron and her team did the lion's share of the drafting of that. And it is some of the most pleasurable briefing I've read. And I've done a lot of cases with Aaron and Paul. So this was this especially well done part of the brief. Like the initial briefing was excellent. And I owe that to Jordan Pratt for coming up with most of the PI brief in that case, but the attorney's fees application could be a very rote discussion, and it was not. It was very engaging, and by the time it got to my desk for editing, I was more or less reading it with a bucket of popcorn more than anything else.
Great, thank you. I have a question here from Jeffrey Wood. He asks, I don't know if you have any comparative data on fee shifting in other civil rights cases, but it would be interesting whether certain types of civil rights claims are preferred in this regard. For example, racial discrimination versus religious liberty. Would you agree?
I would. And if anybody's inclined toward, and Aaron, you may have some other follow up on this too, but if anybody's inclined to do some academic research and law review writing on this, I think that'd be a helpful topic, frankly, to kind of lay out where these fee awards have landed. And some of the difficulty in finding that is going to be many cases, these issues resolve with just settlements. So there's a negotiated settlement with the parties, and it only rarely goes to fee application. And I think, and this is just going from gut, I don't know that I have any hard science behind this, but I think that's largely because, at least on our side of the V, it's sometimes difficult to get motivation to file the application that you're going to get 53 cents on the dollar, 16% of what you're asking for. You know, that kind of thing has a sort of a depressing effect. And also, I'll say one more thing for our practice. You know, we're based in Dallas, but we litigate all over the country. I've got, you know, a client in New Hampshire, a client on the Big Island of Hawaii, down in Boca Raton, and everywhere else in between. Where do I set my hourly rate? And so one of the great things that Judge Sinatra did was to actually bless my hourly rate. And so now I actually have a published opinion that says I'm worth this much money. And I'd like to take that to my boss at some point to remind him. But at least I can take that to a judge in the future to remind them that I'm highly qualified, according to Judge Sinatra, at least in one jurisdiction of these United States. But Aaron, I don't know if you've got more to speak to on that.
No, but I was just going to pick up on something you said, which is about, you know, how a fair amount of this doesn't get litigated, especially by, you know, kind of some of the most qualified folks out there. And part of that dynamic is a lot of big law firms are just incredibly reluctant to actually file fee applications because they just don't want the risk of a court saying the fees that they charge their clients are not reasonable, especially if you're a national law firm. And, you know, it becomes even more sensitive if you think about firms that do like bankruptcy work and the like, where they have to have like court approved fees. And so it's just not uncommon at big firms to kind of have a more of a mentality of, we'll take kind of any remotely reasonable settlement that we're offered, because we'd rather not, you know, have to go justify, you know, have some judge somewhere in some locale say, well, I don't think that's reasonable to charge, you know, down here in South Carolina. And then you've got something on the books saying that your nationwide fees that you charge all your clients aren't really, you know, appropriate. So I think, you know, and frankly, if we'd still been in big law, we probably wouldn't have been able to file this fee application. We're not in big law. We ourselves had to give that some thought and whether we were comfortable with it. I think, you know, if the state had made a little more reasonable offer in our negotiations, that would have impacted how we all thought about it. But it is tough. It's not great. I mean, you know, like we have a couple of colleagues who to this day, like, take it as some sort of personal insult that they in Bruin, you know, got this fee award that said certain people didn't have any special expertise and, you know, really weren't highly qualified to be doing anything. Like, nobody wants that. Nobody wants that on the books. And so that's part of that dynamic of, you know, going to a judge you won before versus a judge you lost before. But I too do have the sense, you know, that there is just a little bit of, you know, that religious liberty claims may not fare quite as well as some of the other types of claims in under the civil rights laws.
I think the examples that I drew out there sort of set the point, you know, where we settled where we did with Kennedy, because that's all we were, I mean, going to that court in the Northwest Washington in Seattle, you know, I just don't see us coming away with more than $1.875 million in fees, even though it was a 7.5 years worth of litigation. Now, Americans United, which is not exactly our ideological ally, files in a more favorable jurisdiction, perhaps, for them, but way less time in litigation, and they come away with just as much or more. That disparity, I think, speaks for itself. And I think we could repeat that over and over again. If I'd had time to research it more, I certainly would have. But I've got these other cases going on. But your other point, just to underscore, I think it's a really good one, Aaron, that it's a $1 trillion decision for some of these firms to litigate these fees. I get it. And it's not just First Liberty cases that they're working on. You know, we do a model that's very similar to the ACLU, and they do the same basic thing. But I should have talked to some of my friends over there to find out sort of what their big wins are, to just give a better comparison. But I my gut says that they're not taking the same haircut that we are. It may be, you know, high and tight, but it's not, you know, it's not a fashionable one like mine. They're taking a much more sincere haircut. We're taking a much more sincere haircut, I think. I go back to actually the days of the Obamacare contraceptive mandate. And I remember distinctly once those cases had been run through Hobby Lobby and the Sisters of the Poor, the new administration comes in and immediately wants to settle because they don't want to deal with any of these issues. And we're happy to move on, frankly. But again, there was like, you know, 10 or 20 cents on the dollar that we were selling for fees that had lasted in litigation for 3, 4, 5 years. So anyway, I think we've probably beat that horse well into the ground, but I think those points that Aaron raises are good ones. I don't begrudge Big Law from not litigating fees, but I am happy to have people that have come from Big Law that were willing, Aaron and Paul in particular, to litigate this case as a service to those people in Big Law now to say, well, if Aaron and Paul can get this much, then we're just going to go with what they said was approved. I think that's going to prove to be very, very helpful. And frankly, on both sides of the ideological fee. Matthew?
Thank you. A little panelist prior to Matthew, I saw a question in there that I'd actually be interested in, you know, if Jeremy has thoughts on, which is the effect of the Lakey v. Steiny, the court's decision saying that you can't get fees for winning a preliminary injunction if it gets moot. To me, that seems a little wrapped up in the court's seeming dislike of preliminary injunction litigation these days. And I think it's been a struggle we've dealt with in a lot of our cases, and not just even in, you know, kind of the public interest or fees context, but just that there just seems to be this growing hostility toward it. Used to be very much the norm that especially kind of legal issue stuff, you just sort of litigate that through a PI and that would all kind of work. And you know, I'd be curious how much you guys have thought about that and does it like impact the way you think about your litigation model, knowing that there's a little more risk in going that path from a fees perspective?
Yeah, look, it does impact us because now you've got to drive things to final judgment. And really in sort of a backdoor way, the court has required us to engage in more litigation rather than less, because now we can't just sort of resolve it at the PI stage, call that a final order. We've either got to go through summary judgment, we've got to go through trial, got to get to some level of final order, a consent decree or something like that, something that triggers a final decision of the court. And that can be time consuming. There's a lot more briefing that goes into that. Sometimes there's a full blown trial that's got to go into that. And that results in us helping less people as well, because the more time you spend on one case, you don't have enough time to spend on another case. You can't bring in new clients for those things. And so if the goal of deterrence is to bring in private litigators to make sure those nation's civil rights laws are enforced, well, we're going to have to reduce the number of enforcement actions that we're able to take. But at the end of the day, I think the effect of it will be that we'll try, you know, this sounds much too Avis-like, but we'll try harder, right? We'll just get to this final order more quickly. It also is a negative here is that it motivates cities and counties and the others to take a calculated risk in litigation. I mean, if they can just survive a PI or if they can just roll the dice to see what happens in a PI posture, they may get out of it for a lot less than what they would have gotten out of it previously. So they can go through a PI, lose the PI, change the statute, ordinance or law, and moot the case. And, you know, we're kind of stuck holding the bag. Now, I hope I didn't just say that and give away the game, but there are enough city and county litigator or lawmakers that already knew that part of the game, because I've run up against that more than once in my lifetime. But I hope that won't continue to be the case. The nation's laws on civil rights, in particular the area that I focus on, in religious liberty, is far too precious for us to give up, you know, the enforcement of them. And certainly First Liberty is not going to do that just because of Lackey versus Cinny. But I'm not a huge fan of Lackey versus Cinny for those very reasons, with as much deference as I can muster up to give to the court in their decision in the process anyway. But yeah, I hope that gets the answer.
Yeah, no, and it's been interesting for me. You know, I mean, we have, as I said a little earlier on, I mean, we have the kind of cases we do with you guys where we view them as cases we're taking on a pro bono basis, but we also have plenty of cases where we are litigating constitutional issues on behalf of clients that are 100% paying us and are very happy to you know, like they'd rather not go through all of the discovery and all of the process, but it's not going to scare them off. And it's been interesting trying to get a sense of whether states are at all backed off by, you know, we try to look for times to remind them, like, look, I get that you see a value in dragging this out and forcing us to go through discovery on things that you really don't need it on, but you do realize you're driving up your own bills, you know, and it's important for that to be something we can say that actually has some backing. It's a less valuable way to push back on states if courts aren't really going to make them pay what it cost us to litigate, if they kind of force you through, you know, like, the sensible way to deal with Lackey is to say, okay, fine, once we lose a PI, you know, absent something in the decision that, like, really gives some promise of reaching a different result, let's just all enter final judgment and call it a day. But unfortunately, there seem to be way too many defendants who are like, no, we see this now as an excuse to just drag on the litigation even longer and longer in hopes that maybe if we make you spend enough fees, you'll give up. And, you know, I think we're both fortunate to have a lot of clients who are like, that's not what I want, but I'm in it for the long haul.
Yeah. And this is where I'll pick back up with Justice Marshall, where he says that this is attorney's fees are not the elixir to solve the funding problem. Thankfully, we've got millions of people, maybe thousands, if not millions of people that do support the work of First Liberty Institute. And they're not, you know, they're not employed by the United States government or any local agency. They're giving of their own resources to make sure that if the government's going to violate your civil rights, you don't have to pay an attorney to get them back. And so thankfully, we've got that that wind at our sales to push us forward. And so they really can't, the Lackey versus Sinning, I guess I'll put it this way, it could sort of resolve or hamper the issue of the recovery of fees, or at least prolong that and make them much more difficult. But it's not going to end the competency of counsel side of things there. It may limit how many we can help, but we're still able to attract not only good attorneys at First Liberty, but the ones we partner with at Clinton Murphy and in all the big law case firms that we work with throughout, you know, DC, New York, and elsewhere. So they're still going to be motivated because they have a motivation of the ideological question over the financial one. But I don't want to lose sight of what we've already talked about in this teleforum, which is those go together, that ability to be reimbursed by what you've done, but also to obtain private attorneys general to enforce these civil rights laws. I think those have to go hand in hand. Otherwise, we don't have the deterrent effect that it was intended to have. So my hope is that in the long run, Lackey won't matter that much on that point. But because you're still going to have to go to final judgment somehow. It may not be at the PI stage. It may have to come at the MSJ stage. But either way, we're going to get to final judgment some way.
Great, thank you. We have time for maybe one or maybe two more questions, depending on how quickly we can do it. But this one is from Terry Dowdle. He says, should prevailing defendants get attorney's fees? Not the case in the Ninth Circuit, at least.
You want to take that one, Aaron?
I mean, I think it seems to me that the answer probably ought to be rarely. You know, I mean, maybe it doesn't have to be never, and, you know, but like, probably if you have the kind of truly frivolous or abusive case that you would think would be appropriate for something, it's going to get thrown out fast enough that you've probably paid essentially nothing anyway, and you can deal with all of that through sanctions. So it's just, you know, it's a little harder for me to see the justification for that when if the thinking behind it is to create an incentive structure. I mean, at least in the context of civil rights violations, like, one of the reasons you have to counter the incentive structure is because defendants pretty much always have ready-made counsel to show up and represent them.
Yeah, that I think that's right. And part of the reason I kicked that to Aaron first was to just kind of calm myself down, because this is actually near to me. We've got a case pending, a petition of the Supreme Court right now that started the injury occurred in 2015, December of 2015. And we're just now getting to the petition at the Supreme Court of the United States. And in the litigation process, we've lost to the district court and the Court of Appeals twice now. We had to go up to the 11th Circuit, back down, then back up, and lost twice. The second time we lost at the 11th Circuit, the Florida High School Athletic Association, who's the defendant respondent now, they put in a fee bill against our Christian school. Now, this is a small Christian school in Tampa, Florida. don't have, you know, buku dollars that are flowing through there other than the graciousness of donors and parents that spend tuition dollars there. But for merely asserting their civil rights, in this case, the ability to pray over a loudspeaker prior to kickoff of a football game at the state championship, for merely asserting that right and trying to press that right in court, the state agency is saying, you got to pay us our fees. Now, Ron DeSantis heard about that, made a phone call, I suspect, and that fee application went away pretty quickly. But it nonetheless sticks in my craw that the government, who has already allegedly violated your civil rights, would turn around and for rewarding you for taking advantage of one of the core systems of our democratic republic, seeking redress of your grievances in court, they would seek to stick you with the bill. I just find that to be fundamentally unfair and bordering on morally wrong. I just put it up in that level of almost morality when I put it, think about it that way. So I with the question, I say, no, I don't think the defendants that are government agencies ought to be able to recover from a plaintiff absent some of the qualifications that Aaron put forward, which is if it's been done in a way that is, you know, clearly frivolous, and not just like someone thinks is frivolous, but clearly frivolous, meant to be abusive, and all those other adverbs that come with it, then maybe I'd be considering that. But absent some showing of some real malice aforethought, I think we ought to be very slow to allow the very important check and balance of individual litigants insisting upon the government following and respecting their civil rights. We should be very slow to reward a government who routinely oversteps its own bounds when it comes to the nation's civil rights. So I'll step off my soapbox now so we can end on time.
Great. Thank you. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank you, our audience, for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.